Hello, everyone. My name is Grace Okafor, and welcome to another episode of the podcast Conversations for a Life Economy. The series is brought to you by the British charity Reboot the Future and by the Institute for Ecological Civilization, ecosave.org. The most universal ethical principle in history is called the Golden Rule. Treat others as you wish to be treated. What would it mean to extend this idea to the environment? John Perkins calls the result a life economy, living in ways that foster mutually beneficial relationships between human activities and the environment, driven by the goal of maximizing long-term benefits for both people and the planet. Each Life Economy podcast episode features a significant leader who is working toward this goal. We take a deep dive into the values and experiences that drive their work, the transformations they are working toward, and the ways that listeners can succeed at similar initiatives in their own life. Our guest today is Mike Hoffman, Executive Director Emeritus of the former Cornell Institute for Climate Change Solutions. Mike received his bachelor's from the University of Wisconsin, master's from the University of Arizona, and PhD from the University of California, Davis, and is passionate about helping people understand the grand challenge of climate change through our relationship to the foods we all love. Mike has published a variety of climate change articles in the popular press, including The Hill, Fortune, and USA Today, and is lead author of the book, Our Changing Menu, Climate Change and the Foods We Love and Need, which is a science-based message about what is happening and what we all can do about it. His TED Talk, Climate Change, It's Time to Raise Our Voices, has been well received, and he teaches climate change leadership, an online e-Cornell course. Mike's life experiences include growing up on a one-cow dairy farm, serving in the Marines during the Vietnam War, being a father, and many years in leadership roles at Cornell University. Mike is committed to sharing the climate change story until he can no longer. I'll now hand the floor over to our co-host for today, Ecosys President Philip Clayton.
Thanks, Grace. And Mike, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
We enjoy featuring some of the people who've been involved in the imaginal conversations that Reboot the Future sponsors. These are these private conversations that probe deeper levels of experience and values for people who are leaders across multiple sectors. And we were particularly excited when we met you on the Imaginal Conversation at the platform you have and the message, the powerful message that you're sharing. So what I wanted to begin with is to give a chance for something of what really drives you, what has led you to this impactful work. And I think I'd like to have you take us back to what it's like to grow up on a small farm in the Midwest. What is the relationship to nature and to other animals that you had as a boy that might have created this focus and this drive that has been a part of your career and life ever since?
Well, Philip, I think it's simply I was immersed in nature as a young person in one way or another. That could have been the farm animals, the horses we had, the calves, the pigs, you know. I had a pet pig way back when named Yogi, and a pet crow. So, and essentially,
wait, Mike, a pet crow? I don't think I've met anyone who had a pet crow.
There are not many of us. Yes. We got Carl as when Carl was very young, although it could have been Carla, thinking back on things. But I raised Carl just like you would a baby, feeding it 24 hours a day. But the crow was just on the farm and stayed there. It didn't go back to the wild, and the wild was only half a mile away, the forest and the woods. But incredibly smart. Using vocalizations on the farm that you never hear otherwise, that I would wake up to in the morning. I'd go horseback riding, and Carl would be on the rump of the horse or on my shoulder. But that was just kind of like in stride with the way we live. My brother Danny and I would do crazy things like run through the woods and try to be like a deer, jump over logs. We also hunted. I mean, that was part of our livelihood. Fill the freezer every fall with rabbit, pheasant, deer, venison, and so on. So I guess my connection to nature was kind of natural. That's just the way I grew up. And I moved around, but that is part of my psyche and will never leave. Just stepping outside and feeling the wind on my face or listening to the birds, it's all right there.
Mm-hmm. I realized how different your experience is from many in the world today when you told me once that you could tell the sound of the wind in different kinds of trees and leaves, whether it's evergreen or deciduous, that's a kind of natural connection with nature. What advice would you give to people who have never had the chance to be immersed in nature? What you got as a gift growing up on that farm, most people in the world today, in decreasing number actually, have had the chance to do that. Is there a way that those of us who've grown up in cities can experience something of what you experienced?
Well, here's a simple one. Look up. I love clouds. And I remember as a kid laying on the lawn and watching the clouds go by, and my buddy and I would try to, you know, well, that looks like such and such. That looks like a goose, whatever. But today, that's still with me. When I go out in the backyard and look up, I still try to find an animal. And sometimes I won't come in the house until I find something that I recognize. But so that's one simple thing, just to look up. Another is obviously doing your best to get into the context of nature. And that could be as simple as standing next to a tree and just listening, feeling the bark. I've been with redwoods a number of times, and it's almost impossible not to give them a big hug. I mean, this massive plant there for hundreds of years is just, it's almost overwhelming and brings a tear to the eye. But I don't think you have to look far. Look down at a crack in the pavement and watch the ants. There's a colony down there someplace. So I guess maybe the message is, sense it. Look, listen, smell. It's there. There's just, unfortunately, too often, many things interfering with that connection.
It may be an obvious question, but how much of your work as an environmentalist and now with the food movement is fueled by, grows out of that fundamental connection with nature that you've had since you were a boy?
Maybe the word is respect and understanding. I think another part of growing up was a respect for the world around me. And that's probably one of the key parts of what has driven me to be an entomologist and study these amazing creatures, but also in the context of agriculture and how to manage them using ecological approaches. And had a wonderful time doing that. But again, it's respecting it. It's not trying to understand the intricate relationships between, say, the good insects and those that might be damaging the crop. And how can you aid that beneficial insect in doing its job? So it's an appreciation of those intricacies. It just brings me around from, again, the respect of nature and applying some of these, quote, natural things to manage systems like farms to the benefit of everybody. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, like, give them a helping hand.
Yeah. Another thing we like to do on the EcoSiv Reboot podcast is to understand the deepest values that drive you as a person and that have driven your profession and your project. So how would you name a couple of the core values, the guiding values that you'd like to see expressed through everything that you do?
I think one would be truth. And that's where science comes in. And you're trying to use, or are using, the best knowledge we have to make a decision. So that's, I think, a lot of things I turn back to or rely on are, they have to be factual, the truth. Obviously, there's emotions and so on, but as a scientist, that's my grounding. And add to that value, I'll just call it caring for the world out there. Why did I look for improve ways to manage pests because I was concerned about the overuse of pesticides and the environmental impact that has. And maybe the third one would be responsibility. I think we have a responsibility to each other, other members of our species, but also to the world around us. And put those together, and I believe that's pretty much a driving force behind what I do.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting, when you describe your fundamental values, they don't sound subjective, you know, like a feeling or something. They seem like guides or dispositions to how you live and act in the world. You sound engaged from the outset to me.
Yes, and I, so in my professional career, I've been in academia. And some think, well, okay, you know, they're up in the tower somewhere doing things, but I'm also part of the land-grant university system where, in fact, we do things for society. So that's the perfect blend of the science, the facts, and then making sure, one, that those the research we're doing is actually has a need out there. It's not just an academic exercise, and then getting it in the hands of the user. So kind of it's the whole full circle of new knowledge and then its application. And that also means working with the person applying that knowledge to make sure it fits their need. And it's, you know, it's a practical solution, not just some publication in a journal. Sorry, but we need more than that.
One last question. When you think of your core values, many people think of humans as separate from nature, and the values and priorities of humans are very distinct. Do you tend to see that division of sort of humans and human values and nature, or do you see the two in your values and in your beliefs as much more deeply interconnected?
We are interdependent. I mean, if we continue on our current track to devastate the world around us, I'm speaking specifically to climate change, we will pay the price. So we have to me, it's all integrated. And I'll put the dependence more on us, on nature, than the other way around. We are totally, do we want fresh water? Well, you know, do we want food to eat? All of that takes caring. Do we want the forest around us, the birds to listen to, et cetera? You know, there's somewhat of the aesthetic side, but there's a very practical side that, as you know, the golden rule, treat the earth as you would like it to treat you. I really like that golden rule.
Mike, we'd love to ask you some questions as it relates to this current chapter in your career with the Cornell Institute for Climate Change Solutions. So you currently serve as the ED of the center. Can you share how you came into this position of leadership and a little bit about what you do, and more broadly describe the kind of space the Institute is fostering as it relates to our understanding of the environment and actions to support it?
Well, I've got a long history of leadership roles at Cornell University. So the 30 years I was there, 20 of them were actually in leadership roles, 21. So I guess I was fortunate enough to have the right talents, the right mix of talents to find myself in those kind of roles. And I loved it because that's where you bring about change. More so than just being an entomologist, now I can move on to much broader things. Now, just to clarify, the Institute does not exist anymore. So I am sort of a past director of the Institute. But the role of that very much goes back to what I just mentioned about the land-grant university. Agriculture, farmers face a lot of challenges with climate change, and they need solutions. So that's where information from the university elsewhere was tapped, transformed or made into tools that farmers could use in a practical way to manage the new world they're operating in. So it was a very direct response to a need of the agricultural community out there. And I'll give one or two examples. So when a farmer needs to irrigate, it's somewhat of a guessing game. And they can watch the weather channel, they can watch the weather forecast, but they need something a little longer in term. So what's called a decision tool was made to give that farmer a 30-day window. You will need, unless it rains, if the odds are really good, you are going to need to irrigate or your crop might be harmed. And there were some other tools like that. But again, very practical, solution-oriented to help that farmer stay in business and continue to sort of, as I would say, keep our menu stocked.
That's really interesting because I think that this is kind of segueing into the major topics that you discuss in our changing menu. And before I kind of go into the details of like asking questions about the larger conversation on that, Mike, for those of us like in the audience that haven't read the book, can you in like 2 to 3 sentences describe a general overview of the kinds of topics and the things that you discuss within it?
Well, think of it as a story. And we're using food to tell the climate change story, because we all eat. So when you talk about climate change, it has to be relevant to our lives, and it's hard to find something more relevant than food. So the heart of the book is a menu, starting with before dinner drinks, salads, main courses, sides, coffee, and desserts. And we just celebrate food along the way. We tell people we inform the reader where the food comes from, because how many people know where natural vanilla comes from, or cinnamon, or nutmeg, et cetera. And it's an amazing system, but also changing throughout the world. So we use that as kind of the core. And then we sort of, oh, by the way, climate change is bringing about a lot of changes here and there. And what's being done and what can be done to, again, keep the menu stocked, so to speak. So there's lots of solutions in there, not only what's being done by scientists and farmers and others, but what we can do as well.
So you mentioned just briefly a moment ago about how the Institute was kind of tasked in creating these solution-oriented tools for farmers. And I'm curious about whether there's been any newer innovations as it relates to assisting farmers and collaborating to make more sustainable and climate resilient farming practices. If you could kind of go into that, if there's anything that comes off the top of your head.
Well, there's something called climate smart farming. It's actually a global term that's used around the world. And I've had a farmer say, Mike, that's common sense farming, because they know what's going on. They know what needs to be done. But there are several things that are brought to the sort of on the priority list when someone is using climate smart farming. And that's protect the soil. That's fundamental. Not only a good managed soil can actually capture carbon. You know, many scientists say that we could turn things around if we manage soil globally correctly. Water management in this part of the world is either not enough. Well, if you look around the world, either not enough or too much. So how does a farmer manage that? So that's part of climate smart agriculture. There's also pest. We've got pests moving north as it gets warmer. So that's another component of climate smart farming. So it's a combination of science and facts brought to bear down on the issue. But a lot of it is common sense, because farmers in general are researchers. They're always trying something new. So here's some more ideas to try.
So we're talking about very kind of scalable and expansive topics as it relates to solutions when we're thinking about climate smart agriculture and farming. So I'm sure that as a seasoned academic, you're familiar with the feedback that climate science can be really complex and also a little bit inaccessible from like a science literacy point for the more common population, especially for those people who need to understand how it's going to affect them. Earlier, you also mentioned about meeting people at their level of understanding, which I think is an important note. And one thing that I noticed with the book was how easy it was to follow with the key points in terms of structuring and really kind of breaking down the different sections of this is kind of the background of this food, this is how climate change might impact, and this is the things that we're anticipating or trying to, you know, suggest solutions. So could you describe some of the ways of the other work that you're doing as it relates to the book or more generally with climate change advocacy, maybe generating an open communication on the climate crisis and perhaps translating these really complex concepts into ways that most people can really understand and engage with?
There's a lot of ways to talk about climate change. I already said it has to be relevant, but I kind of seek out the aha moments, like the layer of the atmosphere we live in is only about 7 miles high. Most people go, wow, I didn't know that. You know, that's where all the action is. It's not like, you know, the fumes from your car exhaust just go up infinitely into the sky and out in space someplace. They don't. They're more or less trapped in that thin layer. So it's those kind of things that I think people can grasp and then think, you know, how to think about that? Well, think of an apple peel, the peel on an apple. You know, it's about that thickness in a relative sense. Or when you look up during the day and you see jet trails way up in the sky, that's the top of that layer. So it puts it in sort of real terms that people can see. And then that brings it back to food is we all eat. So there's so many stories that can be told. And when you, you know, pose a risk to coffee, then you really get people's attention. You know, people care about their coffee or their tea. But again, there are stories there to be told. You can use a variety of methods too. You can try to make it personal. If this is your kids, your grandkids, and so on, it's affecting the economy. There's many different approaches. But to be honest, it's hard to beat food.
I think that's definitely a fair assessment. Like, I think a lot of people who will be listening to this are foodies. So that's something that's very personal. Also in the book, that there's a lot of discussion about the factors of the food supply chain that will be impacted by climate change. So I think that's really interesting to consider those factors that you talk about in the book, but also addressing trends that we're witnessing right now with having droves of people moving from more rural centers to urban areas of the country due to globalization, urbanization, just jobs being in a specific part of the country. Obviously, COVID has kind of changed that. Some people have, you know, decided with remote work, they're going to move to a rural part of Arizona. But given that a lot of our audience are folks living in urban areas, I'd be curious to know, how does increasing the population of communities and lifestyles where the food to table divide is so much larger impacts farmers?
Are you saying, how do we address the disconnect from where food comes from and the people and the consumer?
Yeah, I mean, that's a main part of the question. Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, the next time anybody's in the store, just pick up the fruit and look at the label on it and see where it's coming from. It's actually amazing. You may not find that on a bag of potato chips. Maybe you will, where the potatoes came from. But I think it's important for all of us to do that as a way to recognize food comes from everywhere. It's grown around the world and has to get here somehow. It has to get to the grocery store by rail, by ship, sometimes by plane. And all of those things are being affected by climate change. That's kind of another one of those aha moments when people realize, really? It's grown there and has to be transported and stored and get to my table before it spoils. So I think that would be a starting point. And then this might be a little bit difficult, but try to imagine yourself wearing the shoes of a farmer and thinking what's happening to the weather in your urban area. Well, if it rains too much, they can't plant. They can't get in and maintain the crop. If there's a downpour, it can wash away the seed, the fertilizer, all kinds of things. Makes harvest very difficult. So another message we try to convey in our story is appreciate that individual, wherever they might be in the world, for what they're doing to keep that supply chain flowing. Then again, think of the shipping companies and et cetera, the truckers, et cetera, that have to move all this produce. It's a complex system. And we are fortunate to be able to go to the store and just get about just a bit, more or less, not all of us, but most of us, what we want.
This might be a little bit more of a personal question and kind of like just kind of considering your background and your insights. So I feel like urban farming has been a thing that's been trending, at least in, you know, major cities in the US and other places in the world. And I'm curious to know, what are your thoughts on urban farming as a, like a solution to changing farming conditions? So clearly we're seeing more erratic weather patterns in other parts of the country that are supplying the majority of the produce that we are receiving in urban centers. Does that help reduce the strain that, like, does urban farming essentially help reduce the strain of, you know, the stress that farmers are experiencing states away?
I think we need to bring in the term scale of production. Yes, urban farming is important, and you have these fresh commodities right there, and it sort of can also help build a sense of community if others are involved. Now, those are all very positive things. It also helps people understand where food comes from, and you can't just plant a seed and expect it to come up and have a watermelon. You're going to have to fight bugs and weeds, et cetera. So it adds some of that complexity to what it is to grow a crop. So it's important, and there's these other approaches called controlled environment agriculture, like taking a vertical building and growing food inside. That's another approach. It's still very expensive. So most of what they produce in those systems is really high value, like little alfalfa sprouts, those kind of things. So I think I always look at this as it's all hands on deck to supply the food we need. So this is an important component. But then scale, when you think of the thousands, tens of thousands of acres of wheat, we're not going to get flour necessarily enough from urban gardens, and the tons and tons of apples, et cetera. So it's important for multiple reasons, but don't forget about the rest of where the food comes as well.
Absolutely. I think it'd be kind of a little bit unrealistic to think that urban farming alone would be the one thing to make sure that everybody gets enough produce.
No.
So it's to my knowledge that you have an event with the Culinary Institute of America in June. Can you share a little bit about what it is and perhaps why this may be a significant moment for your current work?
We are striving very hard to build partnerships so that others can tell this story. And in a sense, chefs are on the front line. I can't get this commodity, or I can't get this vegetable anymore at this time of the year, or it's no longer available. So they're seeing it. They're changing their menus. I'm engaged with a chef in Arkansas who's actually put together a meal he calls the Last Supper. And the point of that is, it's not literally the Last Supper, but it's kind of like a menu. It was an event sort of, not a regular meal, but just pointing out to people what's happening on the menu, which is also an extraordinary educational opportunity, which I would just love to see expanded a thousandfold. But no, we are going there. They're having a conference on the future of food. We're going to meet with students. We're going to give a seminar to the students. The students, as we understand it, are very, very concerned about this. A lot of the topics on the main conference are climate change and food. So it's the goal of going there is to share what we are doing. We've already done that through a Zoom meeting with their deans and faculty. But now this will be a chance to be one-on-one with the students and hopefully some of the leaders in the food industry around the world who will be at the conference. It's just part of our effort to network and help others see the value of the way we tell this story and then potentially share.
That sounds fantastic. And I think this, you know, segues perfectly into a few other questions that I had about individual responsibility. We've been talking about more like higher level ways of implementing change as it relates to being a little bit more conscious with our food supply chain and how we're growing and producing our food. So I want to start with how we usually kind of frame climate change and a lot of the individual actions surrounding responsibility and controlling our own carbon footprint. So the conversation often leads to discussions about plant-based diets. So being vegan, going vegetarian, things of that nature. This often comes from a personal choice, right? To improve external factors. Take, for example, myself, I'm a vegetarian. And, you know, that's something that just works for me. But I know for other people that perhaps that they don't want to be making some of the sacrifices related to, you know, reducing red meat into their day-to-day diet. So what are some of the ways that you imagine changing menus can play a major role in changing behaviors?
That's the big question. We can share information, you can help inform people, but will they change? Just a quick aside, we're actually funded to do a national survey to try to get an answer to that question. Can we use food to bring about more behavioral change than the traditional message of, say, melting glaciers? It's sort of a comparison. So stay tuned. We'll have an answer for that. But you're right. That's the big question. Can we change behavior? So I'll just focus on red meat. So one option is don't eat red meat. We have just lost millions of potential listeners to this story. So the approach we take is treat it as a delicacy, not a staple. I eat red meat, not very often, kind of on the side of a delicacy, and I'm not going to be a hypocrite and tell everybody else I can't eat it. So I think it's... you know, we're doing everything we can to help inform. That's the first step. As far as behavioral change, these are not related to food, but start talking about climate change. 2/3 of the people in the U.S. rarely talk about it. And that actually is the starting point for this whole change that we need, that needs to occur. Make sure you're informed so that the decisions you make that might be a behavioral change or otherwise is adequately informed about climate change. And those are kind of the two key messages we convey to people. Talk about it, get informed. And then obviously, if you're informed, I would hope that would lead to... And the other part of this message is people say, but what can I do? Everybody asks, what can I do? And I think that's where the gap comes in this whole thing. So offer them specific things like get involved politically. It's a political issue in the U.S. or we're very much divided around that. So get involved, communicate it about, again, raise your voice, speak up, get out there, be an activist. And because the topic can be overwhelming, focus on what you're good at. And, you know, if you got one or two or three things that you can really focus on rather than trying to do it all like some of us, you know, you can make a difference. So, and I'll wrap this up by describing this as, given the challenge, find your greater purpose. That's what we need. People, if you want a challenge and you want a great purpose, help tackle climate change. There are communities that are engaged like this and get involved with others. I think the key there is you want to do something, here are a long list of things to pick from and make this your greater purpose in life. Because people who have a purpose are generally more satisfied about life in general. And the antidote to despair is action. So let's start acting.
That's beautiful, Mike. And absolutely, we often don't correlate fulfillment with well-being. So that's a really big note for everyone that's listening. So one last thing that I wanted to touch on before I handed it back off to Philip is, so clearly we're talking about the kinds of things that people can engage with more so on a community level to be a little bit more involved and engaged and active within, you know, creating solutions as it relates to the food supply chain issue, as it relates to climate change. So what are the ways that vulnerable communities specifically can adapt to these changes through local solutions? Because obviously we're going to be seeing rising sea levels in some parts of the world, more arid environments where it's too dry to grow. There's going to be fires, basically rendering a space useless because the soil is not, the integrity of the soil is not fertile enough to grow crops. So what are some local solutions that you can think of that you may suggest for people who might be either adversely affected by climate change or maybe a little bit more tangentially affected by climate change?
Well, let's just focus on water. Let's pick on California with the mega drought. Farmers are doing their part. So now communities are also doing their part to save water. So it's kind of a joint effort. Not all necessarily voluntary, but it has to be. That's water. I mean, I'm fortunate here because I get enough rain to have a lawn. But other parts of the world probably shouldn't have lawns. Have a gravel lawn painted green if you want, like I was used to in Arizona when we lived there. But some of the issues you are raising are just enormous. Sea level rise. A lot of people are going to have to move. And things like don't rebuild where you've had flooding or, you know, sea levels arrive already there. There's going to be movement, a lot of people away from the coast and elsewhere, southern U.S. moving north. So these are huge challenges that require government action, which operates a little slowly at times. But also the other big player in these huge challenges are corporations that are making the big, they can do things at scale. And that's what we need. And they can do them relatively fast. So to address these grand challenges that you're presenting, sea level rise, droughts, et cetera, individuals, yes, but individuals can also affect government by raising their voices.
And Mike, what is that dream that you're engaged in? What would you like to see come out of your work, not only with the new book, Our Changing Menu, but with your work more broadly? If it succeeds beyond your wildest dreams, what will you see beginning to happen?
Social change, changes in behavior. That's the dream. In fact, a social movement. Everybody eats. We all care about our food, part of our cultures, part of our histories. And the dream being, can we use this mechanism of food to raise awareness enough and get people to act, to keep that favorite wine on the table, whatever it might be, we need to act and we need to act quickly. Now, since we all eat, to address climate change, it has to be at scale. Well, I think we can reach a lot of people at scale through food. And again, doing it quickly, you know, with the help of corporations, government, et cetera, getting the word out. I think that goes back to the need or the dream of a network. Everybody along the supply chain, start sharing the word, spreading the word, the story about climate change and food, the retailers, the wholesalers, you name it, let alone the consumers and farmers, all coming together. And that's another point, or point I'd like to make. There are no enemies or no villains in our story. We are dependent on each other. We all eat. So let's join forces and bring about the changes we need, the social changes. And I'm, in a sense, not making this up. There's a very good paper, came out a couple of years, that basically says to stabilize the climate by 2050, one, we have to dramatically reduce our carbon emissions. And then things like talk about climate change, where we can use food. Talk about the impacts of climate change, we can talk about food. There's a whole series of social, what they call tipping points. Essentially, when you really get someone's attention, and it's not going to turn back. So there, food has a role to play. So that's the dream.
Food clearly has that potential to scale because, as you say, all of us eat. We wouldn't be alive if we didn't. What are the nodes that in the scaling of across the food network? Is it chefs and restaurateurs? Is it, I don't know, religious and cultural groups? What are some of the tipping points within the food network that if they do tip, if they do make that transition, could have this kind of global impact?
I would put chefs near the top. And that's the traditional chef that we see in a restaurant, et cetera. But there's a lot of people in food ingredients and related businesses that depend on, you know, ingredients. Well, from all over the world, the retailers, the restaurateurs. But it's all of those, the food businesses, whatever they might be, if they are not aware of the changes around the world that are happening to their raw product, they're probably going to find themselves in competition with somebody, another company that does, because they will maintain that source or find it from that raw product from their current location or somewhere else. So, but I'd also like, then we have the consumer groups and the foodies. Now, we need to have a foodie revolution. People really care about food and are really passionate about it. I think they would also be an extraordinary voice to get involved in this. And then the people on the ground producing the food. You know, a lot of times we point fingers at industrial agriculture and so on. Yes, it has shortcomings, but also there's a lot of positive things happening in trying to address some of the challenges. And, you know, whether you like it or not, many of our larger farms are where most of the food comes from. And most are family farms. You know, again, it's the corporate farm. Well, look closely, and they're real people. And I always remember a gentleman way back when that I was a farmer, and in the room was an environmentalist and a nutritional farmer, environmentalist, and organic farmer. And I asked the two farmers, why do you farm? So this was a conventional farmer. And he said, it gets me closer to God, closer to my children, and closer to the earth. Clearly, somebody out there pillaging the planet, not pillaging the planet, not at all. And I asked, well, is your son or daughter going to take over the farm? He says, I don't want them to. It's too hard. So that's another thing, putting a face on food, so to speak. So I think together, that's again, the dream is to bring those entities together with a common voice.
It's so clear in your message, both in this podcast and in the book, that you find that businesses can play a central role, even the crucial role in the transformation. You write, for example, about BSR, the Business for Social Responsibility Group. And in other of the podcasts, we're featuring people in businesses who believe that there's more of a chance to scale quickly and scale effectively through the private sector than government subsidies or nonprofit work. Am I getting it? Is this what you believe is crucial for the food transformation?
Absolutely, yes. That these major corporations who are the movers and shakers of the world, who are, play huge roles in the food system. I don't have a major in business, but I think it's business sense, common sense. If you want to stay in business, you have to adapt. And you can also, you're at scale, minimize your contributions to the climate. I mean, there are people making distilled spirits and now decreasing the weight of the bottles. I mean, the opportunities are unlimited in what can be done. And if you're worried about employees getting to work, well, you know, some days that's going to be tough because of climate change and it's too hot to pick apples or whatever it might be. So it seems to me that these major corporations are major players, in my opinion. Like, we all have a long ways to go, but they're positioned to make big changes.
Thanks. Two final questions. In one of the closing sections of the book, you use the title, How to Be Courageous. What's the role of courage for you and for those of us that you're hoping to inspire to action?
Well, I think I would try to define courage as major component of being a leader. Major piece of that is being a risk taker, intelligent risk. And moving against the wind. We have to do that. The wind is pretty strong. I think that would come from deep in all of us, but we have to be courageous. The alternative doesn't look very good, of not being courageous.
Mike, we always close the podcast with the same question. It's a theme that's come up in our conversations in the past. So I'll ask it simply and straightforwardly. Mike, what gives you hope? What is it that in the end gives you hope?
I've actually thought about this word hope a lot recently. This is just Mike Hoffman trying to define some this term, but I think there's hope that is somewhat shallow. Yes, I hope it gets better, and then do nothing. But then there's the hope that has some action behind it, some courage behind it to make the changes. So let's put it this way. I hope the second hope is the dominant one out there, to get people activated, to make them do things maybe they didn't expect they could do. And that's where I see the hope.
If you want to learn more about the work that Mike is involved with, you can purchase the book or Changing Menu on all major digital bookstore platforms. For more ways to get involved, you can also visit the book's website, www.ourchangingmenu.com, or visit Mike's online course, Climate Change Leadership, on the eCornell site.